Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
America's obviously been fighting a war on drugs for close to 40 years at this point. And what I want to find out from you to start with is, what do you see as being that war's major successes, its D-Day landings, if you like? And what do you see as being its more signal failures?
It's easier to start off with a signal failure, and that is to categorize the drug problem in the United States and the world as a war. And as you've seen over those 40 years, we've had lots of different discussions around the term war. War usually has a specific enemy, oftentimes fairly easily identifiable, and there is an outcome, a win or a loss, and all of those things do not apply very well to the drug problem, the complexity of the drug problem. But there are some wins in some areas outside of the war analogy. And that is the work in that the United States has done over the years with Colombia and the reduction coca crop, the improvements in personal safety and safety of the government, security of the government, and the reductions in opium, poppy cultivation in that country. I think Colombia serves as an the other wins that we need to bring to the attention, even though it was a simple phrase, just say no, under Nancy Reagan, that administrations up through the presidents of the United States have recognized the issue of the drug problem.
So even though you don't like Nancy Reagan's phrasing necessarily, you think there was a public service involved in pushing it to the fore of the public discourse?
Yes. I think that what we've seen over the years has been that the drug problem is often somewhat of a hidden problem, or the drug problem was often thought to be among minorities or in minority communities or economically deprived, which were not necessarily minority, and now we talk about this problem much more publicly than we ever have.
And how much credit do you think the Reagan era and the Just Say No era gets for that?
Well, I don't try to give it, and because we're a very nonpartisan office, special parts of our authorizing legislation that require we have no involvement in any federal election, et cetera. But I think it's important for any administration, regardless of party, to recognize the problem that drugs cause among young people, workforce, kids in school, race relations,
now,
healthcare.
What I want to go from the beginnings of the war on drugs, obviously, it's had different incarnations from the Nixon-Rockefeller era through the Reagan era, et cetera, et cetera. And it's morphed from one thing to the other to the other. But one of the constants has been there's been a progressively greater proportion of certainly local and state budgets, but also of federal criminal justice spending going towards drug interdiction, drug fighting, and so on. And I wonder if you think on balance whether over the last nearly half century of fighting the war on drugs, or whatever we want to call it, on balance, has the country gotten bang for its buck?
So two things. One, it is as misleading to categorize the drug efforts of the governments, local, state, or federal governments, with some type of definition of where the money is going. That's incredibly simplistic, and actually is just, I think, done a great disservice to the discussion. And there are a whole host of reasons that I could go into over that. When it comes to should we be spending more money on prevention and treatment, the answer is yes.
on prevention and treatment rather than other areas of the...
Well, no, I wouldn't say it. It shouldn't, again, it shouldn't be an either-or to take away money from this to an interdiction or some other part of that. Part of the president's strategy is that it really is comprehensive, and it doesn't restrict collaboration, or it doesn't say that law enforcement stays over here, prevention is over there, and by the way, treatment is over there. These things should work in concert, they should be supportive of each other, and they should be understanding of each other's roles and missions and how they can help each other.
Now, obviously, the drug issue is an issue that transcends domestic policy and domestic discussion, and there's a lot of concern at the moment that Mexico has become or is becoming something of a narco state, and that beyond that, it's at risk of becoming something of a failed state. How does that complicate the domestic U.S. policy debate over drugs, over how to minimize the impact of drugs? And at this point, is it realistic to say it's in some ways more of a foreign policy conundrum than a domestic conundrum?
Well, one, I disagree that either it's becoming or has any potential to become a narco state, or number two, that it has any potential to be a failed state. I would, after my four trips and multiple meetings here in the United States with Mexican officials and my seven trips to the southwest border, just disagree vehemently with either part of those last two statements.
Well, let me take it back a bit then. If not a failed state or a narco state, a state bedeviled by extraordinarily high levels of violence associated with the drug traffic and the money around drugs.
I would say that the extraordinary levels of violence in Mexico are absolutely correct, and that there is a drug nexus, but we have also clearly seen, particularly in the last several years, the organized criminal cartels becoming much more involved in other crimes in addition to drug trafficking. And it is certainly a foreign policy issue as much as it is a cooperative issue between the United States and Mexico. But it's also, and I just came back last night from Lisbon in Germany, but it's also, I mean, clearly a global issue, and it's a foreign policy issue for the world's countries.
Now, whether or not my categorization of Mexico, of what's happening in Mexico, is one you agree with, there's clearly a lot of discussion amongst opinion makers, amongst the media, and amongst the general public about the spiraling costs, both domestically and overseas, of the way in which the war on drugs or drug policy has played out in recent years. And there's a lot of evidence that some aspects of the political attitudes around drugs domestically are changing, and we see that with more and more people supporting medical marijuana laws. We see it in California, perhaps, with fairly significant degree of support for Proposition 19. I've talked to Senator Webb about drug policy in the past, and he's obviously quite cynical about much of the drug policy. And I wonder, where do you see American drug policy heading in coming years, given the changes in the political discourse?
Well, I think the president's strategy that just came out in May, and of course it came out after our initial conversation in the spring, is a very balanced and comprehensive strategy, and I do not underestimate people's frustration or strong feelings about a lack of success in a war on drugs, whether in the United States or worldwide. If it's been talked about and going on and expenditures have been made for 40-plus years, and yet people still know that their child could get drugs in high school, that their neighborhood could have drug houses or drug dealing, or that they have a friend or a neighbor or a coworker who has been impacted or affected by drugs, then you can understand that frustration. Where we have so clearly failed is in not helping people understand that there are some very cost-effective, basic ways of working through prevention, of understanding that treatment can be effective and is half the cost of incarceration and can still keep the community community safe, that all of these can actually be done, but we don't have to throw up our hands in frustration and say war on drugs has failed, therefore we have to go to legalization. We actually should be smart enough to look at these other prevention and treatment issues.
So is that where you see the direction of drug policy heading, as more of a medicalized issue, more of an issue defined in terms of treatment rather than punishment and so on?
I do, yes.
I mean, how do you see that playing out in the next few years on the political
side? Well, I see it playing out, one, in the president's budget request for additional funding for prevention. And these are science-based or evidence-based practices. The additional request for funding for treatment. And the fact that talking about addiction is a disease, recognizing that in the new healthcare law that has taken effect in the United States, that treatment and understanding of drug dependence and drug addiction is a part of primary health care. So making health care huge and significant care and issue, when in fact it has almost been entirely a criminal justice issue, is I think, about being smart on drugs.
And you're saying in the past it was exclusively seen as a criminal justice issue?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let me continue on the political theme. And you sort of hinted at this just now when you were saying legalization isn't the answer. What happens if Prop 19 passes in California in November, and then other states, maybe Colorado, maybe Oregon or Washington, what happens if you end up with a handful of states that essentially walk away from one of the central tenets of federal drug policy? Does it set up a constitutional crisis or something approaching that if states start taxing and regulating narcotic substances that at a federal level are still considered illegal?
Well, I think the clarity that we have to have is what Proposition 19 says. And essentially, it doesn't say that the state will tax and regulate and control. It says that it will give the authority to cities or counties if they, in fact, wish to exercise that authority. And that's if it passes. Now, on the constitutional issues and preemption, et cetera, those are questions that are clearly best delivered to the Department of Justice, rather than to me. The other part is that no country has legalized drugs. And as I said, I just returned from Portugal, and although it's widely touted that they've legalized drugs, they have done nothing like that, and as it was clearly explained. So no country has legalized drugs, and I think the countries throughout the world recognize that drugs can be quite dangerous, can have terrible effects on their populations and their people, and that there are important and necessary efforts to regulate them. Arresting people for every violation for drugs is not, in many cases, the smartest way to deal with what is both a disease of addiction, and also what's also a criminal justice problem.
But coming, and I understand what you're saying there, but what happens if California becomes the first state in the world, essentially, to try and create a legalized market for marijuana? And I know you said that the state wouldn't be taxing it, and I know that's true according to the language of Prop 19, but there are also a number of state senators in California proposing bills that would immediately kick in a statewide regulatory structure if Prop 19 passes.
And I probably wouldn't speculate on what would happen if Prop 19 passes, but I would go back to the original point that the Justice Department has made, is that it is still a violation of federal law. The other part that I would say is that when I look at every sitting elected official at the highest levels of the state and the federal government that represent California, and when I listen to the candidates across the political spectrum that have taken positions opposing opposing Proposition 19, because it is such an incredibly poorly crafted proposition. And remember, the Western states that have initiatives or propositions, the vast majority of states in the country don't have that authority to put these things on the ballot the way Oregon, Washington, California.
No, I understand that. And, you know, I read Prop 19, and you know, I might differ from you in terms of whether or not I think legalization is workable or desirable, but I do agree with you that Proposition 19 is not worded very well, and it's very vaguely worded, and it sets up all kinds of conflicts. And I guess that's what intrigues me. What happens if it passes despite the fact the political classes have opposed it, despite the fact the district attorneys oppose it, and so on and so forth? It presumably sets up tremendous tensions at many levels of government.
Well, I would only say that, I couldn't speculate on what would. I mean, it would be an incredibly complex set of problems that the state of California and the United States would have to deal with. But the history of propositions and initiatives, and I know having lived in Washington State for the last 9 years, that there can be some really oddly written and poorly drafted things that end up coming into law, and then spend incredible amounts of time and taxpayer dollars as they wind their way through the courts, eventually reaching some level or some definition of what they actually meant. So I would just leave it at that.
So sort of coming back to a more general conversation about changing public attitudes around drugs, there's obviously, certainly in California and much of the West, growing popular disillusionment with the way in which the federal efforts versus drugs have played out in recent years. And we talked about this earlier in the interview. But obviously for a major national policy like an anti-drug program or a war on drugs or whatever it's called to work, it to a degree has to take the public with it. And I wonder how the federal government can preempt growing disillusionment with federal drug policy. What sorts of policy reforms and institutional shifts can and should the federal government either be putting in place directly or seeding the money for so states can put in place?
Well, and I think this is where an initiative state or a state like California is a bit of an anomaly. The legalization community, those in favor of legalization, are incredibly well-funded. They are focused, they are organized, etc. They were able to electronically have marijuana legalization as the top question for President Obama last year in his first virtual town hall. I truly believe, after spending every week traveling this country for a year and a half and listening to people, that getting up every morning and saying I must legalize marijuana is actually not on everyone's mind. And yet we know that they are very good at getting this message out. There are a lot of things that are on the plate of the federal government, from the economy and jobs to a war in Afghanistan and the winding down of a war in Iraq. If you are a single-focused, well-funded, strategic entity like the marijuana legalization community, that's the only thing on your plate.
No, I don't disagree with that, but I guess what I'm wondering is, and you talked about it earlier with redefining the war on drugs as a public health issue rather than a criminal justice issue, how can you keep in states like California where, for whatever reasons, whether it's because of the efforts of a legalization community or any other reason, there's a significant percentage of the population that no longer signs on to the tenets of the war on drugs? How can the federal government, in a sense, lead the public rather than be led by the public on drug policy?
Well, I think you've raised, I mean, your point is excellent. The people that that are leading those common sense but well-thought-out efforts in California to oppose this have a great deal of the deck stacked against them because of a lack of resources and a lack of funding when it comes to that. But I think that when if the messages can be made, and I think as I read op-eds by citizens, by teachers, by school psychologists, by others, oftentimes not law enforcement techniques, that they rely on grassroots techniques. They rely on traditional, but also to a certain extent, social media, and we just have to hope that people listen to them also.
Now, you know, let's say Prop 19 becomes a footnote at some point, and you know, there's obviously this much broader issue that you've talked about already. This issue to redefine drugs more as a public health crisis and there's a criminal justice issue, especially, and we talked about this both today but also last time we talked, especially when it comes to lower end users, the lower parts of the drug economy. And that's a linguistic shift, but it's also a huge psychological shift, because for a generation, a large part of the public has been conditioned to think the only way to fight drugs is through using the criminal justice system. How do you bring conservative critics or conservative commentators along for the ride on this reform journey?
The conservative critics, who are mostly my colleagues for many, many, many years, are already there. They recognize and will clearly tell you across the board, whether they're police chiefs or narcotics detectives, that merely trying to make arrests, trying to make seizures, trying to incarcerate, etc., is not a particularly smart way of addressing the drug problem here in the United States. They are already well beyond this. Now, the second part that is going on, of course, is that every state is looking at how to reduce their prison population, how to reduce their criminal justice costs, and at the same time keep their community safe. And if there are ways like the HOPE Project in Hawaii, like the Drug Market Initiative in Seattle and Providence, and I think a dozen other cities, that can be used in a smart way about keeping the community safe and also reducing costs. I think that a lot of folks are already there.
What about, you talked about conservative critics in the district attorneys, the police and so on. What about in the political realm?
Well, you saw Bill Bennett, who was the first drug czar, and you've seen his statements repeated on CNN and others about the drug policy that this administration released. I'll be talking to other groups, and I've heard from Attorney General Ed Meese, the former Attorney General, and others, that looking at this policy is smart. I've also been up on Capitol Hill speaking with a number of members and a number of staff members who see this policy as being a smart way to go after the drug problem.
So you said that this is tied in, obviously, to the fact that a lot of states just can't afford to keep their prison systems at the level they're at. And this was actually the question that I had next for you, which is, in an era of fiscal austerity, can localities afford to keep in place busting at the seams jails, and can states afford prison systems of the scale and cost that they've grown accustomed to over the last 30 years? And if they can't, how can the federal government help them scale back their criminal justice infrastructure while keeping the public safe?
Well, you're right. First, we've seen, especially over the last three or so fiscal years, that prisons that had been planned to be built are no longer being built, that jails and prisons have reduced prison space, that several states, whether it was Texas or New York, have reduced prison space. So you're absolutely correct that the down cycle in the prison population and incarceration has already started. Now, here's where I think the federal government can be helpful, and it can be helpful in providing evidence-based and rigorously evaluated programs, whether it's in technology or whether it's in treatment programs that can help to address the drug problem. I think what oftentimes, though, is missed is that when you look at the report that we do every year called ADAMS, which tests people coming into jail, people who've been arrested in 10 different sites, that when they, and it doesn't matter whether they're arrested for murder or for shoplifting, the drug problem among people being arrested for all of these different crimes, not just drug crimes, is just astoundingly high compared to the general population.
Do you have any numbers that you feel comfortable?
The ADAM data, which was for 2009, which was just released a couple months ago, shows anywhere from 50 to 80% of the people being arrested, as I said, from shoplifting to murder, reporting a drug, and alcohol, by the way, I should also mention, plays a prominent role. So helping people understand this clear linkage between the crimes that have been committed and the drug and alcohol issue is, I think, helpful.
What are some of the other, I mean, that's obviously one issue, is to just highlight the scale and extent of addiction. And you talked quite a lot in this conversation about the importance of the federal government promoting rigorous evidence-based programs. What are some of the programs that you think are particularly effective nationally or internationally, and how can they become more a part of the normal everyday functioning of the criminal justice system?
Well, just like all systems and all bureaucracies, the criminal justice system can move slowly. But I think that the things that I see that have been tested include drug courts, which started with one only 20 years ago. And although that seems like a long time, there are now about 2,500 of them around the country. And Mexico just recently opened up their first drug court in Monterrey. And members of the Russian Duma and members of the government of Russia or the Federation of Russia were here and toured drug courts in New York, Miami, and Washington, D.C. So one, drug courts. Two, I think intensive supervision of people who have been arrested and are out on bond or are on parole or under supervision for probation. And those intensive supervision efforts include drug testing, because if those folks are not on drugs while they're out, more than likely they will not be involved in other crimes. And then I think the drug market initiative that is being tested in about a dozen cities and is being led by John Jay College and David Kennedy is worth looking at, although I think that is to be evaluated.
I'm less familiar with that. Can you talk me through what that is?
It's an interesting process of using a police and prosecutor, and we all know that in many, many states, in most states, you know, drug crimes are handled with diversion programs. The person is arrested. The judge will say, you know, as long as you complete a treatment program or you stay on your best behavior, we'll do away with the file and the sentence. This is actually a pre-arrest diversion, and that is that rather than arrest someone physically, fingerprint them, photograph them, and have them taken out of their neighborhood in the back seat of a police car, that they are brought in or they are asked to come to a voluntary meeting in the evening in a police department, and the prosecutor and the police department show the evidence about what they have been doing, and then ask them to make a choice as to whether or not they would like to look at getting help, or whether they should end up being prosecuted. And so this helps, because quite often when a person gets an arrest record, a downward spiral, particularly for a minority kid, has already started. So I think there's a lot of interesting programs that are worthwhile.
And when you say they're given a choice, it's literally you go into treatment, et cetera, or you face a mandatory sentence or something else.
Well, it's actually a little more complex than that, because they're asked to come in with a letter signed by the prosecutor and the police chief. Their family comes in with them, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and mom and dad and grandparents. And then they're showing the evidence of what they've been doing, which is oftentimes some type of low-level street neighborhood drug dealing kind of problem, which that they've done. And then they can go and the assessment can be made, because they may have a drug problem themselves. They may need education. They may need help in vocational, etc. And they also have the power of their relatives asking and supporting them to make the right decision.
And is that a pretty crucial part of this?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Is that a crucial part of it, the relatives?
Yes, it's got to be, you know, it's so much of that is the power and authority of the, not just the criminal justice system, but the power and authority of the family and the neighborhood to say, please get on the right track. And we When you look at one other issue, I think there's a lot of success on the dealing of crack cocaine, dealing with crack cocaine in the United States. Crack cocaine was mostly a phenomenon in the African-American community, and it's been significantly reduced. And I think that is the power of the neighborhood and the families and education about the dangers of crack and the problems that crack causes as much as any governmental intervention.
Now, as you expand these sorts of programs, in some ways you get not just a sort of peripheral reform, but you get to a fundamental reform of what the criminal justice system looks like. And over the years, I've spoken to a number of criminal justice reformers like Dora Shearer. I think she was the ex-head of the Arizona Department of Corrections. And she says, and she's sort of half joking but half serious, she says that the goal is to succeed at reducing drug usage and recidivism and more general criminal activity to the point at which the people involved in criminal justice put themselves out of business, that they end up sort of in charge of a superfluous set of institutions. Now, that's obviously a little bit utopian, but on a more realistic scale, what is your measure of success?
Well, first, one of the realistic scales issues that we have set is the number of deaths. What is not in the public eye as much as it should be clearly have been the fatalities as a result of drugs. They eclipse gunshot wound deaths in the United States. In 17 states, they eclipse car crash deaths. And if you look at the most recent data on car crash deaths in the United States, it's less. This was 2009. It is less than the 2007 drug overdose deaths. So this is a huge issue about people dying. And, of course, the driving force in that and the death rate has been prescription drugs. So I think prescription drugs, which are not coming across a border but are coming out of medicine cabinets, is one that needs a lot of attention to. So reducing deaths and reducing the number of people that have to come into an emergency as a result of drugs is important.
So that's obviously a very tangible, medically-oriented measure of success. How else do you measure success?
I think the other measures of success, besides looking at the fatalities in the emergency room and treatment, will be the number of young people that engage or utilize, initiate in drug use. And we have set some pretty ambitious goals over the next 5 years to do that, and I think that that'll be important. And then, of course, there are the other kind of more intangible, because the drug issue is so intertwined with dropouts from school, the healthcare costs, and of course with a prepared and educated workforce.
And again, do you have target? Because I know a lot of it is target based. Do you have targets for?
We do. We have targets in the early section of the president's drug control strategy.
Now, you've obviously been in this job for a while now. I presume you will be in it for a while still to come. What legacy do you hope to leave after your time at the ONDCP is over?
Well, I think that one, not being overly concerned about the legacy and particularly my legacy, but more concerned about how we should leave this country as it deals with the drug problem. So making people more aware of the drug problem. As you well know, there has been a shrinkage in media coverage, and that there is much more coverage of particular themes. The drug issue has been around a long time, so it's hard to get it to the attention of the public. So looking at ways to bring it to the attention of the public, not just through traditional media, but through social media, through other ways, I think is important. The signature issues that I have put on my plate for us to deal with over these several years are the prescription drug problems, the drug to driving people behind the wheel with drugs in their system, and then bringing to the attention of the people that prevention programs can actually work and keep kids from ever becoming involved in drugs.
I'm always interested in how history interprets any given moment. But I wonder, if you sort of fast forward 100 years or 200 years and you think of a group of historians looking back on late 20th century American policies, how do you think they're going to interpret the late 20th century drug wars and the huge increases in imprisonment that come about, at least in part because of those drug wars?
You know, that's an absolutely fantastic question. And I just finished reading Daniel Okrent's book on Prohibition, which, you know, almost not quite 100 years later, going back and looking at Prohibition, both in a very balanced way. And so I think that if I was going to put myself 100 years or 200 years into the future and I look at what will come about as a result of medicines and technology, medical technology, you know, right now there are experimentations going on with vaccinations for cocaine. That people can actually be vaccinated against becoming a cocaine abuser or experiments in that way. So I think that there will be a lot of medical processes involved. I think that as we face more difficult economic times, that they will go back and look at this time as saying that perhaps part of the driving force of the change in looking at this as a public health problem was also the economics, which of course is very much aligned or very much analogous to Prohibition. So I hope that they will see that in this short period that the changes being made in drug policy are similar to what was talked about when President Nixon declared drugs public enemy number one.
And do you think they'll be able to understand our motivations? Because obviously sometimes you look at the past and you think, well, what on earth would drive a group of otherwise sensible legislators to propose this policy? You know, maybe it would be boiling heretics in boiling water in Tudor England or something. We look at it and we think that's impossible. And I wonder if a lot of the drug policies that you've inherited and that you're obviously trying to shift somewhat public policy around, policies like, you know, the Rockefeller drug laws, for example, do you think generations from now people are just going to have an absolute problem understanding our motivations?
Well, you know, I mean, we're a country that has had greater imprisonment rates now, I think, than any other country in the world, greater imprisonment per capita than Russia. I think that we will probably begin to understand, because of this high imprisonment rate and the great deal of punitiveness that we have enforced, people will look at this drug issue and say, but as more people speak out, and I was in Philadelphia Saturday with 11,000 people marching who are in recovery from drugs and alcohol, people will recognize this more for the public health problem, but more importantly, they'll recognize that people can overcome this, that they can be back being productive, tax-paying, working citizens who are taking care of their family if government works, and it won't work for all, but if government works to put those policies in place with the same level of enthusiasm that we did to look at the problem by saying, well, we just need to incarcerate more people. You know, my favorite saying with police chiefs, and they all have the same saying, is they don't talk about a war on drugs. They talk about we can't arrest our way out of the problem.
Well, that quote is actually a nice place for me to sort of come in with the wrap-up question that I have, which is I started off talking about a war on drugs that linguistically at least takes off in the early 70s with Nixon and Rockefeller's language at a federal and state level around how to approach drugs. And obviously, we're now in a moment where fewer people, at a public policy level anyway, are using the military language to define and explain this problem. When do you think the war on drugs came to a close?
Well, I'd love to say it's when I did an interview with the Wall Street Journal the first month I was in office, but I think, as you well know, it takes much longer to change that mindset and attitude. But frankly, I've heard that among the professionals less and less, and well, as I said, I never really heard it among my professional colleagues, but I've heard it being referred to in the foreign press more about the war on drugs than it is anymore in the American press. So I think it'll take a while for us to not only convince ourselves that this isn't the best way to deal with the problem, but I think that it will take longer to convince our foreign counterparts that we are being smarter about how we approach the drug problem.
How long do you think it will take?
Oh, I'd love to tell you 5 years, and I think that would be optimistic, but I think it could be a decade before we are looking at this in the comprehensive, smart, sensible way that this balanced approach is taking us.
But it is fair to say that at a federal level, at least, the policymakers no longer view themselves as fighting a war on drugs.
I would say that in my meetings with federal law enforcement officials and on, that and this goes back to my time as the police chief and the president of several police chief associations, that they never really talked about it or saw it in particular as a war. There are criminal elements, and certainly we battle with criminal elements, regardless of whether they're bank robbery groups or drug trafficking or human trafficking groups. But when it comes to the entire issue around substance abuse, I think that professionals see it with the complexity that it is, which is both public safety and public health.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.